Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 24th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 7th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Auction.com, HousingWire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. For event information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Sean O'Toole. Sean is founder and CEO of PropertyRadar.com, the only company that tracks every foreclosure in California with daily updates on all trustee sales. Prior to launching Property Radar, Sean successfully purchased and flipped more than 150 residential and commercial foreclosures. Leveraging 15 years in the software industry, Sean used technology as a key competitive advantage to build his successful real estate investment track record. He had years of experience in other startup companies, and he brought that expertise to our industry. Sean, once again, we welcome you to our show.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Property Radar, not just a foreclosure tool anymore. So let's talk about what other services and other clients that are using Property Radar.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was kind of a natural thing for us to expand beyond foreclosures. It's always kind of part of my vision. And as a real estate investor, I started off investing in foreclosures, but back in the early 2000s, as foreclosures went down and down, I had to find other investing opportunities, driving around looking for vacant houses, looking for folks who were tired of being landlords, and lots of other things. And so I kind of knew there was an additional tool set needed for investors. And then also being a real estate broker, being able to, find and target a market and really get to know that market and reach the customers within that market, I knew was really critical for realtors. So this was just a natural evolution for us.
The ease of finding information, since I started years ago, I'd go to a HUD auction and literally have to make copies of a Thomas Guide map page and then look up the property and put little X's on it, et cetera. And nowadays, I don't think people could possibly appreciate how much easier it is, which kind of leads to two things. They think that it's so easy, sometimes they're casual, like in appraising a property, but they also think that expense-wise, that the cost per month is expensive, when they really don't realize how much more it used to be.
We've definitely spoiled folks, and they absolutely have no appreciation for how much work it is to pull that information together, or what it was like before services like ours made it so easy to access.
You have kind of a wide range of clientele now. What's the feeling you're getting back, the feedback you're getting from them, how the market is going?
Well, definitely hearing from our investor customers, it continues to be hard to find, properties. It's still a reasonably competitive market on the buy side. On the other hand, on the sell side, it's slowing down a little bit. It's taking a little longer to unload the properties they've bought if they're flipping. So it's a little bit more challenging on that side as well. So, in a way that's good for us because we provide folks lots of new opportunities for finding deals. And so it's bringing them kind of back to us to help find those other possibilities, because what they did yesterday, probably isn't working to the same degree that it did a couple of years ago.
If we're talking about an area like San Jose, San Francisco, Where are they relative to the peak of the market? And is that still a hot market today?
Yeah, it is. You know, Silicon Valley's a very, you know, a special market still, just because technology, specifically the technology coming out of Silicon Valley, is really leading the world, and is one of the strongest parts of our economy right now. And, you know, it continues to attract people to the area with very well-paying jobs. And, you know, if you look at affordability in that area, it's at an all-time low. But that, of course, is looking at the population that's there, not the population that's coming. So, you know, what you really have in that area right now is a situation of displacement. You know, the folks that have been there are really getting, you know, somewhat pushed out by if they're not a technology person.
I had an interesting speaking invitation. We went up to San Jose and spoke in front of about 400 to 500 Chinese investors. And at the after I got done, there was a Q&A, and there was a gentleman that mentioned that he had bought a home in San Jose for $1 million, and it now is worth $2 million. He'd only owned it for a couple of years, and he was going to hold on to it until it was worth $7 million. And I just thought, okay, that's just in my head. I said, that's a lot of expectation out of one property.
Right.
And yet I didn't have his context. And so within just a month ago, I got his context because he was from Beijing. Beijing has, we know somebody that owned three properties in Beijing. They paid $50,000, $50,000, and $100,000 for the properties. They sold them for $500,000, $500,000, and $2 million.
Oh, geez.
So when you have a combined multiple of 15 and you take your money to someplace else, I'm betting you expect it to do well.
Yeah, you probably have unreasonable expectations, right? There's no question, you know, from all reports that I've heard that, you know, a lot of property got built in that part of the world that's unfortunately even sitting vacant.
Right, but I guess when you bring that kind of money in from the outside, you have in pockets, you have what you would consider in the appraisal world undue stimulus.
Yes.
So that's where I've landed this this time, because I look at what I thought was going to happen to the market, and it didn't, and so I'm really having to look at things that have surprised me. Anything in 2014. Surprise you?
You know, no. I mean, I think, you know, kind of mid to third quarter last year, you know, I kind of said that I felt the, you know, we're going to start seeing sales slow, and we probably continue to see some price appreciation, but as the slowdown in sales, you know, and I expected to see sales slow because of lack of affordability, right? We went up in price too quickly, and rates also increased, you know, putting pressure on affordability. And so I expected we'd see sales, slower sales, but not lower prices. And then, you know, after some period of time, we'd probably start to see prices lower. And it's played out almost exactly like that.
Yes, congratulations. I'm only kidding you. No, you were right, but I'm still shaking my head as to why. When we talk about lack of affordability as the reason, then we ought to be able to look back and say that always with declining affordability is this occurrence of less volume, and it hasn't happened. So
yeah,
now you have to say, okay, well, what's different this time? Not that that's the answer.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? Is, you know, it's like the chartists in the stock market. And I think that historical information is important, but you really do have to look at what is different. And, you know, so while we saw declining affordability using traditional measures leading up, you know, to 2007, 2008, what you saw was real affordability using, you know, pay option ARMs dramatically increasing. And, you know, what I felt was different this time was the fact that we've got a tighter credit. You know, 2008 is still recent enough that we've got a little tighter credit issue than we did in 2006 when the pay option ARM came to be. So, well, the pay option ARM was around for a long time before that. So the misuse of the pay
misuse
ARM,
of it, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of gets to the point where, okay, we, in the years like 2004 and 5 and 6, we had undue stimulus. And since then, in many ways, we've had reverse stimulus.
Yeah, certainly in 2009 and 10. And yeah, and then, you know, credit's still been tight, although it is, you know, well, we hear reports here and there that it's loosening and, you know, other things. So, you know, and that's really the big question is how loose and for who.
Well, what do you where do you think the direction will go, and what would be the reason it would go there?
You know, so I think it's really tough because you've got two camps out there. You've got a camp that says, wow, we just created this disaster, you know, by loosening, and therefore we need to be super tight. And on the other hand, you have a camp that says, you know, well, housing's holding back the economy, and we're holding back the economy by not loosening. Right. And so it's kind of to what degree, you know, which camp wins. I think, you know, DeMarco going out as the head of FHFA and Watt coming in, you know, pointed towards, well, maybe we'll see some loosening. Right. You know, DeMarco was a pretty careful steward of, you know, overall pretty careful steward of, you know, the taxpayer, whereas I think Watt is more interested in increasing home ownership opportunities. And I'm not saying one's right or wrong, but it's definitely different.
Well, and I think that's what you have to do now is look forward and say, okay, well, where is the bias going to be? Is it going to be for undue stimulus or reverse stimulus? Because it's usually one of the two. It's not vacant.
It's a pendulum constantly swinging. Yeah, and it swings from one extreme to the other, which is why we keep getting ourselves into trouble and why we have such a volatile housing market. You know, now housing markets aren't volatile in the sense of stock markets where they, you know, can change pretty quickly. You know, it takes a while for things to move. You know, it's just like last year when I think we got to the point where we were overpriced, you know, about 10%, the market didn't instantly correct 10%. It still hasn't corrected 10%. It's just in the early innings of that still, because, you know, from the time you see a shift to the time the shift actually occurs in housing can be a couple of years. It was the end of 2005 that we saw a slowdown in sales like we saw at the end of 2013, yet, you know, we didn't actually have a crash until 2008, you know, 2.5 years later. So housing market takes a while to play out, which is great, because if you pay attention to the signals, there's a pretty good chance you can keep yourself from getting hurt.
Okay. Do you feel that in the next couple of years that we're more likely to be flat or go down than go up?
Yes.
Okay. And that's nationally and California as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, you know, are there pockets that are still undervalued? I think the answer is yes. Are there pockets that are, you know, overvalued and may still go up, like Silicon Valley, because of a fundamental change in demographics? Possibly. Even there, Silicon Valley is getting pretty expensive.
Right.
I have friends in Silicon Valley that make, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 a year, and that are saying they can't afford to live there anymore.
That would seem to be overpriced.
Not very sustainable.
No. At some point, you're going to have to sell a house to somebody that's got a job.
Right.
Instead of just bring in millions of dollars from somewhere else. When you say the property is overvalued, what is the basis of that? Because most of the time, California, if you look at a chart, has spent most of its career in an overvalued position and then gone up from there. At least that would be my take. So if we're considering where we are overvalued, then we've spent a lot of time overvalued. And that, I guess I want to get your definition of why you think it's overvalued. And is it because policies have now put a lid on where we're probably going to head?
Yeah, so, you know, and I think that there's been plenty of time, sure, that California has been in that overvalued, you know, bucket. There's also been times when California has been in the undervalued, although it tends to be shorter periods of time in that undervalued bucket and longer periods of time in the overvalued. You know, and for me, value is, you know, basically almost ownership versus rental, with the understanding that people are typically willing to spend 35% of their, you know, 35% of their income to be an owner, versus about 25% of their income to be a renter, right? There's kind of a long-term discrepancy of what percentage of your income you're willing to give up to be an owner versus a renter. So ownership is more valuable to people than rentership, which makes, you know, sense.
Right, because there's some of the goodies. Now, that kind of leads to an obvious question. We've got some deficits that we're trying to, it doesn't seem like we've talked about it at all for a while, but we're supposed to be improving the deficits, and real estate would be one of those punch bowls where they start taking away some of the goodies.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, you roll back to 1998 where, you know, they, you know, despite talking about the value of long-term home ownership, they put incredible incentive to be a flipper. Right, where you can take out, you know, $250,000 to $500,000 tax-free every couple of years by, you know, moving into a house and either fixing it up or being in the right place at the right time, and take that money and go stick it in a mattress and move on to your next house every 2 years. And that was a that was, I think, you know, great policy for, you know, remember in 1998 we'd had years of stagnant housing after the crash in the early 90s, and, you know, they're trying to do anything they could to get it restarted. And, you know, clearly that, among other things, worked, because that was really a turning point for housing. But is that good long-term housing, you know, policy if, you know, you value home ownership and the rest is let's turn everybody into flippers and incentivize them to sell every 2 years? Doesn't make a lot of sense to me as policy, and it doesn't seem to reward or incentivize the right, you know, things around long-term ownership. So yeah, I think you know, some of those things, you know, should be probably addressed. However, you have pretty powerful, you know, lobbying between the Realtors Association and the Home Builders Association that doesn't want those things touched, and so far they've been pretty successful in protecting them.
Has area like Sacramento, sort of mimics Riverside County. We had our FHA loan limit lowered in Riverside from 500 to 350.
Yeah.
And that definitely has been a reverse stimulus, to where if you were a builder thinking you were going to sell something for 485, it isn't happening.
Right.
So now, one of the things that, one of the studies we did, one of the chapters was the ratio that usually existed between FHA and Fannie Mae loan limits. And we're still way closer to the Fannie Mae loan limit than we've been, other than in the last few years where it was completely, you know, out of whack. So I just wondered if you had heard any rumors of FHA actually getting back to a more normal ratio, which would mean that would be continually lowering to get to that number.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting point. I haven't tracked it closely enough to say. You know, I definitely think that, you know, I personally believe that we should have some federal backing for housing, but that it should ultimately, you know, be backing for housing that's affordable for folks, right? So based on an area's, you know, median income and 35%, you know, kind of spending 35% of your income on housing, you know, what's a reasonable maximum price? And that's where kind of the government should show up as a backstop, you know, is to support that level of housing. And then to the degree that housing gets beyond that, you know, if private money wants to come in because they believe in that area and they want to take full risk, and in other words, I mean, not federally insured banks taking the risk that get bailed out by taxpayers, but true private money coming in, then let them lend to whatever limit they want.
What's interesting about what's happening is in our industry, there's been a lot of changes. First of all, the money came in as buyers. Hedge funds came in as buyers and, you know, bought everything or made an offer on everything that moved. And now that money is showing up as lending to investors.
Right. And you know, and they just made that natural shift because, you know, I think they wanted to de-risk somewhat. And so by taking some of the investors' money and the rest, they're in with a little less. They get, you know, still get decent returns. And, you know, it's just hot money looking for a place to land that's as easy as it can.
And I think my gut feeling would be that they're not going to get their volume satisfied with that crowd, because there's only so many people that own 25 houses, that they will someday land on the owner-occupant with some loan programs that are safe but make the volume happen. So we'll see.
I don't know. You know, it seems to me like it's that, you know, to some degree that shift was, behind some of these things. Sometimes you have to remember there's real people looking just to justify a way to continue to make a living, right? So you got a group of guys that work for hedge funds, have access to money, and they're out buying up single-family homes, and then kind of the powers that be say, yeah, we don't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that person now needs to find a new job, you know? And so I think to some degree they created a new job by going after that. But I don't know that those folks that were experts in, you know, or built up expertise around investing lending can make the jump then to residential lending and, you know, take that same access and pool of money, which is a pretty tiny pool of money, really.
I mean, it is.
We think about it being pretty big, but it's really pretty tiny compared to residential lending as a whole. And I just don't see it having any impact.
Well,
and I don't see those people behind it having any impact.
Then do you see if Fannie and Freddie going forward in some fashion kind of similar to the way it is?
I don't see any other choice right now because we're in a regulatory environment where they've made, you know, lending essentially illegal privately. I mean, it's just the pendulum swung way too far on the regulatory side. You know, I get why, but what really bothers me is that, you know, all the regulation has been on kind of this punitive stuff and focused on the foreclosure process and the qualification process and all the rest. And not enough has been focused on, to me, what were the root causes, you know, around Graham Leach Bliley and the Commodities Futures Modernization Act and things like that, that really shifted this idea of, you know, too big, or really created this idea of too big to fail. So, you know, they created an environment where banks could take on huge risk, you know, or take on huge risk without bearing any of the risk.
Exactly. They got to filter it to the next guy.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, this whole cycle, you know, really rewarded those folks that, you know, were some of the worst actors, right? We've consolidated most of the lending into a handful of institutions, and we've done it in a way that the lending that happens, they get to make fees on and pass the loans through to Fannie and Freddie, because those are the only ones really making lenders. But, you know, Bank of America, Wells, et cetera, all are the ones making those loans, and they're making all the fees and stuff as they pass them on to Fannie and Freddie, so they're still taking no risk. And, you know, we really screwed up, not only in, you know, and at the end of the day, we as voters should be taking some responsibility here, as much as we want to blame the banks. But we put in the politicians that let the banks create the situation, and then not only that, but we let these you know, politicians then create a new situation that really only improves things, I think, in the long run for the banks, where the banks have pretty much a pure monopoly on making government loans and making the fees on it with very little risk.
Sean, we have run out of time. I know we're going to get to pick this up at the Nixon Library at the I Survived event, and look very much forward to having you on that panel. So thanks for your time today, and take a look at propertyradar.com, and it'll improve your business.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate: Adrenaline Athletics, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, In A Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South REIA, Lavis Associates, Pilot Limousine, Primary Residential Mortgage, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Sonica Corporation, South Point Companies, Spinnaker Loans, Tony Alvarez, UDirect IRA Services, and the Council of Multiple Listing Services. See isurvivedrealestate.com for video of the live event and more on our sponsors.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.